Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Bottom Up Radio Network. That was Christian Side Hug, a live hip-hop performance about the inappropriateness of front hugging in a hip-hop format. Rebel Rouser, are you with me?
Yeah, I am. How you doing?
Did you hear that song?
I heard part of it, but I think some asshole didn't know how to run the buttons and kicked me off the show.
Oh, I think it was tech support.
Was it?
Yeah, it wasn't. It couldn't have been. me. Yeah, that's a song called Christian Side Hug. And Christian Side Hug is in hip-hop format explaining why front hugs are inappropriate. In fact, Jesus didn't front hug either because, again, that was inappropriate. So they made a hip-hop song explaining. And it was funny. My wife and I were watching this. We were laughing. And we can start talking from here. She asked the question, why is it that Christianity is so fucking lame? Okay, the Muslims don't make shitty Muslim music. You know, the Muslims make some good shit. The Hindus, they crank out some good shit. But the Christian hip-hop, God, Jesus Christ. Pun intended.
Yeah, you know, I have theories on this. Because not all Christian music is lame. I mean, yeah, sure. there's some good, black gospel stuff. But anytime you have a predominantly white group and you expect them to make music, I mean, really, what do you expect, honestly? I mean, we're talking about people that invented sitcoms. It's really, there's nothing to expect from white culture that's going to be of any value.
Yeah, that's very true. Very true.
Which is why we've existed from the rape, pillage, and assimilation of other cultures.
Yeah, no shit.
That's our God-given talent, to steal from others.
We're particularly good at killing one another for a living. That's a funny quote I read today. I think of this book by this guy, L. Neil Smith. He writes science fiction type stuff, but he's kind of a primitivist in his bent, and he had a couple of great quotes in his book. I started reading one of them today. One of them is that police are like parents and that they don't want justice, they just want quiet. And another one was that of all the animals, humans are the only ones kill one another for a living. And I think that's beautifully exemplified in our religious justifications for doing just that.
I always love the humans are the only animals arguments for things. They're always really funny to me.
What is what?
When people make those arguments, they use that as a preface for their argument to state their premise. It's like, you know, humans are the only animals that, because there's so many things that humans are the only animals are. My favorite ones are the vegans that are like, did you know that humans are the only animals to drink another animal's milk? And I'm like, yeah, humans are the only animals to make cookies. So.
Although that'd be fucking sick if beavers made cookies. I would eat a fucking beaver cookie. I would totally
It'd
eat
be even more
cookie.
Sick to see a beaver milking a dairy cow.
And then drinking its milk and selling it to other beavers with weird hormones.
Flash boiling it first.
Floating
it full of pesticides and then selling it.
Speaking of churches, this is kind of interesting. Massachusetts just recently ordered this church to stop feeding the homeless in Phoenix. And it had to do with zoning. And it wasn't because they were feeding people. It was because the zoning didn't allow for charity work. So while it's okay for them to serve cookies on Sunday, if the people need food and they feed them charitably, then they're breaking the zoning law and have to go feed the people in a more industrial area.
Well, the
thing
the church have argued is that we're not doing this for charity. We're doing this to buy their soul. So there is a trade here. There's a trade-off. Like, they get to eat, but they have to obey everything we say about God.
Yeah, that's it. Hey, you know, that is it. That is actually a great lead-in for our first clip of the night. This is actually a special present for you, Rabble Rouser. I think it will both make you laugh and also arouse you, and you'll know why as I start it. So here you go. It's just a few minutes long.
Hey, you. It's me, Sarah Silverman. You know, lately I've noticed a lot of really sad, really long commercials on TV with, grossy, sick, emaciated people from all over the world. And it turns out they look that way because they don't have food. And I know what you're thinking. If you don't like it, Silverman, TiVo passed it. I did. You still see them. Especially because, I have a 48-inch plasma high-def TV. So every devastating image is in, brilliant, crisp, vivid. They're in my apartment, you know. So how do I get these people out of my apartment, basically? And I think I figured it out. All I have to do is end world hunger. And then I'm like, okay, how are you going to end world hunger? And then it hit me. Sell the Vatican feed the world. Think about it. We need a hero. And who is more primed to be our hero than the Pope? He's literally a caped crusader. What is the Vatican worth, like $500 billion? This is great. Sell the Vatican, take a big chunk of that money, build a gorgeous condominium for you and all of your friends to live in, all the amenities, swimming pool, tennis court, water slide. And with the money left over, feed the whole fucking world. You preach to live humbly, and I totally agree. So now maybe it's time for you to move out of your house that is a city. On an ego level alone, you will be the biggest hero in the history of ever. And by the way, any involvement in the Holocaust, bygones. I know some of you out there are like, well, why don't those bums get a job like the rest of us? Well, did you know that the average Arby's employee in Ethiopia only gets paid nothing an hour because they don't... They don't have one. The bottom line is this. If you sell the Vatican and you take that money and you use it to feed every single human being on the planet, you will get crazy pussy. All the pussy. And I don't mean literally. That might not be your cup of tea. I don't know what your version of all the pussy is. But you'll get all the pussy. Amen.
And that's how we're going to do it.
I fucking love Sarah Silverman.
That's seriously like one of the most brilliant things that she ever came up with. I really do think so.
Yeah, well, you know, check out some Lenny Bruce.
Oh, Lenny Bruce, I think, right, he's old school. He kind of laid the groundwork for a lot of the Bill Hicks and...
Sarah Silverman and...
Yeah, and many other
radical, hilarious Jews.
No shit. like John Stewart. Actually, John Stewart had some pretty forward thinking stuff when he started doing the fucking Daily Show, whatnot. But hey, Thanksgiving's right around the corner. Are you stoked?
Fuck yeah!
I love Thanksgiving with the gobble.
Yeah, I love having an excuse not to hang out with my family when they're all together.
Ah, fantastic. You know, I'm just thankful. Like I said in the description for tonight's show, we just want to really express our thanks to all the dead Indians who helped make this empire possible. Because, I mean, it's without them, I wouldn't have my iPhone. And
well, I actually have an interesting bit of history that Thanksgiving, and this is not a joke. Thanksgiving actually was. It's a feast that, of course, a lot of cultures have, a harvest feast, a fall harvest feast.
Right.
But the original Thanksgiving feasts were actually started by the first African Americans, the first slaves that were brought over, and the free Africans that were brought that were over here, actually began the Thanksgiving feast prior to the Pilgrims even being here. Let me read the quote for you. This is true. And it's in a book.
Yeah, I remember.
It's true.
Exactly.
Yeah, it says, first pilgrims did not introduce the tradition. American Indians had observed autumn harvest celebrations for centuries before the first Europeans arrived on the continent. Second, although George Washington set aside national days for national Thanksgiving, this is where it is. What the first national holiday Thanksgiving actually was. It was actually Abraham Lincoln who made it a national holiday, and he made it the national holiday the first year that after Emancipation Proclamation was signed. And it was symbolically at least that freed more than 5 million black people from slavery. And the first official November Thanksgiving was the first holiday that all black people in America were able to give thanks for being free from the chains of servitude. But no public connection has ever been made between the two events. And it says that Lincoln didn't make any religious connections to the Thanksgiving holiday. His motives were purely nationalistic. Having divided the nation over slavery in the ensuing Civil War, Lincoln felt the Union needed all the patriotic fervor that such a holiday observance could engender. while black people were the primary justification for proclaiming a national Thanksgiving holiday, no symbolic forms of blackness have ever been associated with the holiday, and not until after the 1890s were American Indians included in the tradition. Moreover, no one used the term pilgrim until the late 1870s. This is probably the only truth about Thanksgiving as it is commonly practiced, is that it started off as an homage to patriotism and has remained such until today. So there it is.
That's it, motherfuckers.
There's your fucking truth, white man. Deal with that shit.
And my favorite thing about Thanksgiving is the evolution of understanding of it. Like, I remember my earliest memory of anything to do with Thanksgiving was when I was in kindergarten, and I remember seeing a picture of people sitting in a church looking really bummed out and then looking really happy and having, like, a buffet dinner with some people with feathers in their hair on, like, the next picture, right? You know, it was like they were evading oppression and such. And it was like, you know, these really sweet pictures. And then, you know, junior high, it's a little more gray. You know, there's maybe a little bit of conflict, but still nothing big. And then high school, okay, there was some killing and disease, but nothing really that was, quote, our fault. And it's not until you get into college and independent study that you actually find out that we were genocidal murderers who spread disease and invaded this land and forcefully took away everything that they had, killed them in huge swaths. I've seen 1492 with Gerard Depardieu. I know the fucking truth. You know what I'm saying? I know the fucking truth.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Speaking of which... Go ahead, please.
Well, you know, talking about Thanksgiving, talking about patriotism, talking about the roots of American civilization as we tell it, I'd like to read something written by a young man named Robert Erickson. I'll explain after I read what this is, but I'll tell you what it was from. Robert Erickson spoke recently in Minneapolis at a Tea Party gathering. There was an anti-immigration Tea Party rally, and he gets up to speak, and this is the speech that he gave to several dozen teabaggers at this anti-immigration rally. Here it is. Hi, my name is Robert Erickson, and I'm really excited to be here. It's people like all of you and events like this that make our country great. Give yourselves a round of applause. I just want to talk about a couple themes this afternoon because I love this country, and I want to see America be the best place it can be. Mr. Gutierrez is getting ready to propose an immigration bill in just a few short days, and we have to make sure he knows that we want a bill that's tough on immigration. Now is the time for us to stand up and make our voices heard. In Minneapolis, where I'm from, we have a huge immigrant population that's been causing a number of problems. With the economy in recession and so many people getting laid off and unable to find work, immigrants should not be competing for the few jobs that are out there. It's just not fair to the folks who have a claim to this land and a right to be here. All across America, they're contributing to the flooding of our job markets, making it hard for Americans to find jobs. Well, I'm fed up, and it's time to let our politicians know that enough is enough, and we're not going to take it anymore. We need to secure our borders to protect our country. We need to restore order and put an end to anarchy that's sweeping the nation. We need tougher immigration laws to make sure that we send these people back where they came from. We need to protect the sovereignty of real Americans. We need to hold our politicians accountable. It is no secret that with an invasion of immigrants comes waves of crime. We see them involved in massive theft, in murder, in bringing diseases like smallpox, which is responsible for the death of millions of Americans. And these aren't new problems. They've been going on for hundreds of years and continue to this day. I say it's time for us to say enough is enough. Are you with me? Are you with me? Let's send these European immigrants back where they came from. I don't care if they're Polish, Irish, English, Italian, or Norwegian. European immigrants are responsible for the most violent and heinous crimes in the history of the world, including genocide and slavery. And it's time to restore the sovereignty of the people native to this land. I want more workplace raids, starting with the big banks downtown. There are thousands of illegals working in those banks, hiding in their offices, and taking Dakota people's jobs. Let's round them up and ship them out. Then we need to hit them at home where they sleep. I don't care if we separate families. They should have known better when they came here illegally. If we aren't able to stand up to these European immigrants, who can we stand up to? We need to send every one of them back home right now. America for Dakota people, not Europeans. They stole this land through genocide and ethnic cleansing. Thank you very much, and we'll see you in the streets. Columbus, go home. Columbus, go home. Columbus, go home. And that was read by a young anarchist who subverted the Tea Party by saying his name was Robert Erickson, a classic Viking Aryan name. And he read that speech. Apparently, the reports say that most of the people at the Tea Party were behind his speech 100% and didn't realize that he was talking about white people. Absolutely brilliant. And even when he began to chant Columbus go home, apparently a couple people started chanting and then realized what they were saying and stopped.
I really want to get that fucking guy on the show, man. I really do.
Yeah, if any of our listeners in the Minneapolis area know who was responsible for that, who Robert Erickson was, please put him in contact with us. You can email us at bottomupradionetwork@gmail.com. We're pretty easy to reach. We're pretty accessible. And we definitely want to get Mr. Erickson to phone in to the show and share with us his experience fucking with these asswipes. Who call themselves, that they're in the lineage of the Boston Tea Party, even though the Boston Tea Party was an advanced form of civil disobedience and property damage and destruction, which these people are staunchly against.
It's kind of funny. But, historical accuracy has never been that important. That bit from that kid is fucking awesome, and it's absolutely perfect. And I have for our second clip of the night, this is just you're the master of the perfect fucking lead-ins to my awesome clips that I have painstakingly picked for our show. This is from Super News. This is the immigration debate. It's from the point of view of the natives as the Europeans immigrated here, and also from the point of view of a bull who you will hear as a person with a scratchy East Coast accent. So this is Super News, the immigration debate.
America!
Finally, we'll be free from the oppressive regime that ruled our homeland!
Oh, crap! More white people! They just keep flooding across our border! Oh, sure! Come on in! Take our jobs! Eat our corn! See what we care! And you know, the second they get here, they just start having kids.
Oh, totally! And you know what's worse? They don't use every part of the buffalo.
That's it. Tonight, after the rain dance, we talk to the chief. Come on, rain!
Okay, that should give us scattered showers tomorrow with a 75% chance of sun through the weekend.
Chief, every day our borders are being crossed by uninvited foreigners. We have to do something.
Well, if you ask me, and hey, this is just me talking here, I say we shoot them all in the head, make jackets out of their skin, and then leave their carcasses to rot in the sun.
Okay.
Well, I say we welcome them. They're good for the economy, they gave us these comfy blankets, and come on, can anyone here honestly say they don't like fire water?
Didn't they kill your entire family in a raid last week?
Okay, I'll admit there are some cultural differences.
Oh, you pale-faced loving hippie!
Excuse me, but pale-faced seems like a racially charged term. Can we call them something less offensive?
Like what, hugs with trees?
Well, their boots make a cracking sound when they walk. Why don't we call them crackers?
Oh, yeah. From now on, everybody calls white people crackers.
All right, so how do we keep these damn crackers from coming here?
We could build a giant fence to keep the crackers from sneaking onto our land.
Oh, come on. You know those crackers would find some way to sneak in. We need enforcement.
I say we lock their cracker asses up.
Enough. Tomorrow I will issue my ruling directly to the crackers.
As protector of the lands between Sacred Bear Mountain and Lake Popozao, I declare the following new laws. All uninvited crackers will now be considered illegal crackers, and we can send them back to where they came from at any time.
Send us back to England?
England? We thought you came from the moon.
Oh,
furthermore, illegal crackers are now required to register with our guest Indian program. And after living in harmony with the land for at least 6 years, they will be given a junior scout card that must be presented at all trading posts, wigwams, wampum shacks, casinos.
Oh, you got to be kidding me.
Yes, you can what?
Yes, we can live here and work in this new land.
It's our basic human right.
Well, what about our rights?
And how dare you fly a foreign flag in our country?
And how dare you... What are you, like a Wookiee?
I hate crackers!
It's the Eagles. They have come to bring us wisdom. Listen.
Hey, everybody, just chill out, okay, man?
Everybody freaking chill.
Chill.
These people aren't immigrating. They're, like, migrating.
Yeah, it's like how we fly south for the winter because it's too freaking cold.
These people just came here because England sucks. I mean, nobody would live in England if they had a choice, right?
It's too freaking cold there. You know, the freaking country sucks. They freaking come here, you know? What's the big freaking deal?
So if we welcome this new wave of immigrants, no harm will come to us?
Probably not, man.
Yeah, what's the worst that could happen?
And so the Indians lived in harmony with the white man forever. And immigration was never a problem in America again.
You like that shit?
Oh shit, that's funny stuff.
Good times. You know, in Massachusetts just decided to spend $1.4 million to teach English to immigrants, and I was thinking about this today, and you know, I think I have issue with that, but it's not like, you know, I'm all down for learning each other's language. I'm currently endeavoring to learn Spanish, if for nothing else, just because I want to be able to speak to some of my coworkers in Spanish in their language. And but this whole notion of government teaching, spending money to, it sounds to me a little too much like we're gonna force you to learn our language. We're gonna assimilate you into our culture. And for my part. You know, I really admire a rich tapestry of people speaking different languages. I think it's kind of awesome.
Absolutely. When we were on tour this last spring, we played at an amazing place in New York City called the Mehenata Bar. It's also called the Bulgarian Bar, and it's known for being a place that local gypsy music is played every night. They play gypsy music there, and they allowed us to come in and play Holy, Holy, Holy because our music was highly influenced and inspired by the Roma peoples, and so we're there, and seriously, there were 9 or 10 different languages being spoken throughout the bar that night while we were there. It was amazing. It was amazing the different dialects that you'd hear of Russian, of Romani, of Spanish, of English, various Asian languages. There was even a group of Ethiopian people there. It was phenomenal, and yeah, everybody was dancing to the same music and having a great time. And this isn't like a talk for like unity and, you know, we can all be together and just, you know, love each other. But, you know, it was amazing to hear the cultural diversity. And it's also phenomenal to me when I meet people from other countries who speak 4 or 5 languages and didn't learn these languages necessarily in schools. It's just culturally, especially Europeans, culturally, you just learn these different languages because you're so close together. It's almost the same thing as you know, if they spoke a different language in Indiana than they do in Illinois than they do in Missouri, and chances are those three groups of people that live in those places would know how to speak each other's languages. And, you know, here in America, we don't even speak English. I often joke about, you know, well, if England had won the American Revolution, we'd all be speaking English. Yeah, so you just thank your lucky stars that England didn't win and you get to speak American.
Yeah, no kidding. It's like, have you seen Idiocracy?
Yeah, I hated that fucking movie.
Oh, dude, it's fucking hilarious. What are you talking about?
But I want to say that everybody that says that smokes mad weed. Like, seriously. All of my friends that smoke weed are like, dude, Idiocracy is fucking funny, man. Oh, my God, dude, I was laughing so hard. I was like,
oh, dude, I
laughed so hard at everything.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, I mean, I guess fair enough. Fair enough. I mean, come on, man. In the future, the most popular show will be called Ow My Balls. You don't think that's funny? And I just love how, like, language becomes more eubonics. And so when he just goes and says, hey, can you guys tell me where there's a hospital? And it's like, they were angry because he sounded faggy. That's just funny, right?
Yeah, mildly. I mean, that's, like, taken on their own, it's funny, but that movie as a whole fucking sucked shit.
No way, dude. Brondo, it's what plants crave, you know? So they water the crops with Gatorade. Nothing. Jesus Christ. Fuck. So, hey, I wanted to ask you a question. To shift brilliantly.
That.
I'm not baked at all right now, by the way.
Yeah, you know, I'm not even in the burn mode. I guess we had a dinner party that we didn't even know we were going to have tonight, apparently. We do brunch on Sundays here, which Travis never came to. But we do a brunch on Sunday for everybody, and, like, brunch started this morning at 10 in the morning, and it hasn't stopped. And now there's been, like, three revolving groups of people that have come in. Now it's a whole new group of people, and it's mostly strangers, and they're all really nice. But, like, you know, I was just sitting
Hey, you know, fuck that, though, because I think you are in perfect burn mode because, you know, you're meeting new people, you're talking about ideas, you're eating food. I mean, I'm in burn mode. I've been burning it up all. I've been burning it since 11 o'clock this morning, brah. You know what I'm saying? I burn
yeah,
that
Yeah, man,
shit.
I burn it down, man.
So while we're on this thing of Thanksgiving, immigration, and indigenous people and killing them and all that shit, I wanted to kind of ask a question today to you, my co-host, from the primitive point of view. Can you kind of give some perspective? Because one of the areas that you and one of the many areas you and I converge in terms of you know, ideas and stuff we agree on is the preposterousness of immigration prohibition in any way, shape, or form. And I was just kind of wondering if you could elucidate a little bit for our listeners, for anyone who might not be too familiar with primitivism or anything, kind of what's the perspective on immigration from that point of view, would you say?
Well, if I were to actually take a hard stance of primitivism, which a stance that has been voiced by various groups and various individual writers who tend to speak from a feminist point of view, I would say that actually it's very anti-immigration. It simply in that if we're going to close the borders, that means we have to close the borders to resources as well. We have to stop stealing resources from other bioregions and claiming them for our own and taking them away from the indigenous peoples of their land. But we don't want to do that because we want tomatoes in January. So we just want to keep them out, starve them, steal their resources, and have them for our own. That's the preposterousness of immigration law, is that we care more about economic product than we do about human life. And I mean, that's passé at this point to even say. But we go so far as to rape, pillage, and destroy our own land base to the point where it's virtually unusable because it's all strip malls, that we start killing other people for their land so we can make it into strip malls. And I hear people say such things as, like, oh, my God, I remember when after the wall fell in 88, our teacher came in and said, did you know they're building a McDonald's in Moscow right now? Isn't that great? And we're sitting there like, what? These people aren't fucking stupid, man. Like, no one wants to eat that shit, not even Soviets. Like, We hear about 4-hour bread lines. Nobody's going to wait 4 hours for a fucking Big Mac. They're retarded. Like, no one's going to do that. But fast forward 12 years, and capitalism has completely destroyed what was once a pretty sovereign nation. I know that you're going to hate that I say capitalism, but that's what it was. If it were socialism destroyed, I would say socialism. But once capitalism is introduced, you see the land base go to shit. And I think a perfect example, that's Cuba. We see a closed bioregion that has virtually no import or export of their resources. And they have the highest per capita rate of bicycles, the highest per capita rate of gardens. They have the highest literacy rate of any nation, the lowest prison population, and they're healthy. You know, people live to a ripe age. There aren't a lot of rampant diseases in Cuba. And it's thanks almost in whole to the fact that they nourish their bioregion and live within it in union with it. They're not perfect. I'm not saying they're perfect. Communism's kind of for assholes. But, you know, the primitivist perspective on immigration, the hard line would be, yeah, no, let's not move around and continue to destroy land bases and move to the next. However, another primitivist perspective would be to say that people have always been migratory people. It's just, I mean, that's a simple truth of life. You had to be migratory to stay with the seasons, to follow the food lines, follow the large game that, according to Patrick Friedman, was all eliminated and decimated before the white man came around anyway. But it wasn't. You had to be migratory. And in fact,
I thought that was in The Lion King, but I'm
Well, you know, I should read more books. But there's entire tribes that existed solely off of a meat-based diet. They lived in the mountains, the high regions of the Appalachian Mountains, where it's very cold at times, and their diet consisted almost 100% of large game meat. They didn't eat vegetation because they lived in a region that didn't grow a suitable amount of vegetation to make it a constant part of your diet. So the diet consisted mainly of meat products, and they followed the herds. They were a migratory people. And so people migrating towards resources is nothing new whatsoever. Whoa, my son just hit his head really hard on something. But my wife's got him. Sorry.
That's rough. Hey, this is live. What is this? This is live. You know, real radio where real life happens, including children falling down. Well, maybe while if you want to tend to your child, we've got a great clip to play for everybody. It's from Ward Churchill.
I was gonna say before we go to Churchill, can you give your perspective as a market enthusiast on immigration? But I think Churchill's going to follow a little bit what I'm saying. Then after Churchill, we can give your perspective and then maybe play a clip by Mickey Mouse or something that would follow
right,
in the
so,
line of market ideas.
So we want to play a little Ward Churchill. We want to play Ward Churchill for the people?
Sure. Did you catch that stab at market anarchism, by the way?
Oh, no. I totally missed it.
I said that you could play Ward Churchill to kind of validate what I'm saying, and then after you say what you say, we'll play some Mickey Mouse to validate what you say.
Such a dick. Oh, God, you persecute me. Okay, do you want to explain to the listeners real quick a little bit about who Ward Churchill is?
Oh, absolutely. Ward Churchill was a professor at Colorado University. He's an indigenous person. He's written many volumes of great books about resistance, both land-based and street-based resistance. He went into the national spotlight just after 9/11 when he wrote an essay on terrorism, and he basically said in no uncertain terms that 9/11 was America's chickens coming home to roost. And he goes on to in-depth elaborate upon that to say that when you exist on the oppression of peoples all over the world, you can highly expect there to be a backlash. And 9/11 was that backlash. And it was a small part of that backlash. And it makes absolutely perfect sense to anybody who takes the time to consider what he's saying. But, of course, the fervor and the patriotism following 9/11, he was immediately fired from his position at Colorado University and since then has been in and out of the court systems fighting for what's just and what's right. I mean, the students of Colorado University have come together across the board to support him. Faculty, academic names such as Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, have come out and spoke for this man, Andy Goodman, saying that, you know, it's just not right that professors are silenced when they have an opinion that doesn't support status quo. But we all know that's what academia is, so it makes sense that he was fired because he's speaking in a system built on lies about truth. And that just doesn't work.
Nice. Well, thank you very much for that. And everybody, this is about 9 minutes long. It's really informative. This is about Indigenous people and resistance. This is Ward Churchill.
I bring you greetings from the Colorado chapter of the American Indian Movement and from Gwarthy Lass, otherwise known as Leonard Peltier, who today as I speak to you continues to sit in a cage at Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, not for anything anyone, even his prosecutor, has been prepared to say they believe he actually did, at least not at any point in the last 20 years. But rather as a symbol of the arbitrary ability of the federal government of the United States to repress the legitimate aspirations to liberation of indigenous people within its claim boundaries. And put the emphasis there on claim. Big difference between a claim and a reality. So that takes me to, with all due respect to the organizers and to the institution, and I do truly appreciate the organization of this event. But my honor is to be not on what was originally on Ondaga land, but what remains on Ondaga land. Now, you got an official document in this state. It's commissioned by the governor. Nice Republican attorney was retained back in the early part of the 20th century to write a report demonstrating that the state of New York had acquired legal title to the dominion it claims as its own, over which it purports a right to exercise jurisdiction. It's called the Everett Report. What this Republican attorney, who was actually an honest man, irrespective of his political standpoint, what this Republican attorney came up with unavoidably in the end was that the entire northern half of New York had never been ceded, had never become the property of anyone other than those original owners. Not a treaty, not an agreement, not a 999-year lease, nothing. Ownership remains vested until there is a genuinely, legally defensible alienation of title and transfer of same. New York State has never acquired it. Welcome to occupied America. Welcome to occupied territory. Welcome to the West Bank, if you want to think of it that way. This is someone else's land. It's being occupied, used to the benefit of another population, another country, actually, to the detriment of the actual owners. That's the essential definition of a colonial relationship. We can all get off into United Nations Resolution 1514 and the open blue water requirement, 30 miles of open blue water, separating the colony from the mother country and blah, 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 blah. The essence of the relationship, however, is the imposition by one country upon another of terms and conditions which deprive the colonized population of the use and benefit of their territory and their resources, so that that territory and those resources can be employed to the benefit of the colonizing power. And it's inherent to that sort of situation that there is a usurpation of the self-governing rights of the colonized people themselves, and an imposition of governing prerogative by the colonizing power. And if you don't understand the nature of the relationship between the United States, the state of New York, and the Six Nations of the Haudenosaunee in exactly those terms, then you don't know anything about the subject, and since you're on their land, you might ought to maybe learn. Just a humble suggestion. What does that make non-Haudenosaunee, who are not the guests of the Haudenosaunee themselves in the sense that they're respectful of the rights and prerogatives of those people within their territory? Well, there's a couple of words that come to mind. They're jarring and they're jangling. And they'll be habitually referred to as white bashing, although it's not restricted to whites. There's some sort of an internalization, a subliminal understanding of the reality of the relationship that caused people out of guilt to repudiate and deny that which is clear as the nose in their face. White bashing? No. When I say words like settler, in the context of colonial discourse, it's not an epithet. It can be used as such, but it's a precise clinical definition. When I say colonizer, same thing. Colonizer is not so often used as an epithet. Nonetheless, speaks directly to the reality of the relationship. And the denial, the pretense that that's not so, doesn't do anything to alter the reality. It simply amplifies in an almost pathological form the nature of the imposition. The colonizer who denies that he is a colonizer becomes the Frenchman in Algeria who pretends that Algeria somehow magically, by a decree issued in the legislature in Paris, became a part of the home compartment, which is to say, France itself. Seems absurd when you frame it in a context like that, with somebody else's country, somebody else's posturing, somebody else's pretension. But the pretension of the French, so that they did not have to allow the decolonization of Algeria, that Algeria somehow was a part of France, is no less ridiculous than the presumption of the United States to pronounce unilaterally and of its own volition that other countries recognized as such by bilateral treaty relations with the federal government somehow magically became part of the United States because that was convenient for the United States. Convenient in the sense that the United States announces its territorial integrity to include indigenous nations, which are entitled to a standing separate from and equal to, at least legally, the standing of the United States government itself. Where does that take us? Well, I'll give you a little personal anecdote of where it took me, because I listen once in a while, increasingly seldom, and my visceral vomit reflex kicks in, I find, much too early as I advance in years to be able to actually listen to a speech by George Bush II. You know, it's just that way. So I get little sound bites, I get the replays, I get Arthur E. Newman pontificating as a leader of the free world, giving us political philosophy lessons in "They're Evil and They Hate Our Freedom" as he takes the freedom away, not just from Indians, but everyone. Yeah, that's the circumstance. But he had a father. Yes, he still does. I think the man's still alive. I haven't checked lately. But last I heard, he still had a pulse. And he made a speech in 1990. And the speech went something like this: I'm committing major U.S. forces to the region of the Persian Gulf in order to convey a message, well, actually several messages, but in the first instance that is a message of warning to the head of state in Iraq that we are prepared as necessary to wage a just war. Just war being to compel the relinquishment of illegally occupied territory, to prevent the wealth and benefits that would accrue from that aggressive occupation of someone else's sovereign territory from accruing to the aggressor, and so that legitimate governments, such as that of Kuwait, would be reinstated. Now, I missed the first part of that, and all I heard him say was that he was going to utilize the force, militarily speaking, of the United States to compel the relinquishment of the occupied territories, restoration of the benefits of resources to the people who properly could be said to own them, and that he was going to be reinstating legitimate governments who have been usurped by aggressors. And I jumped up and I started to cheer. I was doing a dance. You should have seen me. I looked absolutely ridiculous, even in my own mind in retrospect. But I was absolutely ecstatic because I know at that moment he was calling in airstrikes on the White House.
All right. That was a little bit of Ward Churchill. What a badass. Fucking badass.
Yeah, Derek Jensen, who, he's been a guest on here before. Oh, wow. I was getting a really bad echo there. Derek, jeez, Christ. I need this room. I think the FBI's surveillance equipment is causing interference in my phone's reception here.
Okay. Oh, you're good.
Yeah.
You sound great.
Awesome. Thanks. I look great, too. Wish you could see
I'll
me.
Bet you do. I'll bet you do.
holy shit. My banjo just fell over.
That's like, hey,
what a night. At any rate,
Tony in Ohio says, hey.
Ah, Tony, what's happening, brother? I wish I were able to chat with you, but I'm apparently a Luddite these days, and I have no internet.
He says hooray for boobies in chat. I don't know what that means.
I don't think that's an inside joke between Tony and I, but I'll go with that. Yeah, hooray for boobies.
Hey, he's actually got a request. He's asking you to play a little bit of music on your banjo.
You want to hear some banjo music?
Yeah, play a jam for us, Rob Rouser.
It's all out of tune now, but let me see. That I can get
well, why don't you go ahead while you tune it up? I'll give you my fucking perspective, kind of from the market point of view. I found about the idea of immigration. I found actually an article that I wanted to read to everybody. This is from a website called Free Agents. And Robert Riles, I'm going to go ahead and mute you while you tune up your banjo.
Yeah, that's
and,
a good
I'll
idea.
Read this to everybody. All right. Anyway, folks, this is from a website called FreeAgents.com. Throw it up for you in chat. And it's a website. It's kind of a blog site / social networking system of anarchists who are really into economics and markets and vary in the social spectrum. A lot of folks are highly left and really focus a lot on coming up with voluntary mutual aid systems and clever ways to undermine the system and in different ways, economic ways. And this is a blog that I found on Free Agents today on immigration. And, you know, I know for any of you who aren't into the idea of, you know, property rights and certain things as they manifest in the market, that's cool. But sometimes it helps to have perspective from any direction that you don't agree with, because then if you're interacting with someone who has that perspective, you can say, well, let me make this point to you from the point of view of property rights. You know, that's part of the reason I wanted to have Ralph Rouser give his point of view as a primitivist, because where goals converge, sometimes arguments, while they might not come from a social system that we would be into, also end up having the same, can ultimately have the same conclusion. So this is written by Galman Kirsten from Free Agents. This is Immigration, Property Rights, and Freedom. There seems to be a non-trivial number of people, even very high-profile folks such as Ron Paul, who identify as pro-freedom yet have huge blind spots concerning immigration. We don't think the government should be used to violate our property rights either through taxation or otherwise. We don't think we should be subject to onerous government surveillance and tracking. We don't support the government trashing civil liberties or destroying the environment, etc. But bring immigration into the picture, and suddenly you will hear a number of otherwise pro-freedom people calling for the government to commit all manner of harms and rights violations, which they would normally agree are unacceptable. And I'll skip over a little bit. Today I'll begin with the topic that brought this to the front of my mind, taxation and property rights. Skipping ahead a little bit, she says, when you own property, that means you may do with that property what you wish, so long as you are not violating the rights of others. If a person sits at my dinner table with me, occupying space on my property at my invitation and of his own volition, neither he nor I are violating anyone else's rights. It is my right as the property owner to decide whether or not he is allowed to be there. It is neither your right nor any voters nor any government agent's right to decide otherwise for us. The same holds true regarding who I may employ on my property and to whom I may sell my property. As far as I'm concerned, the discussion should be over there. My property, my choice. Your property, your choice. We have no problem recognizing this in other relationships between peaceful and consenting adults, and this should be no exception. Unfortunately, it isn't that simple. Some folks believe that an exception should be made in this case. Until welfare is reduced, the argument goes, we must violate people's property rights as well as other rights via taxation to fund policies and enforcement actions designed to keep out immigrants who, it is assumed, will significantly burden taxpayers through unjust wealth redistribution programs. I think this excuse is nonsense. It's time to kick it to the curb. Let's start with the logic of the argument. Taken to its natural conclusion, it leads to some places I don't think most of us want to go. The general idea, of which this argument is merely a specific case, is that it's generally wrong to violate someone else's rights. But a vast class-based exception can be made arbitrarily against millions of people as a sort of mass collective defensive measure on behalf of taxpayers. We could similarly advocate a ban on junk food, tobacco products, alcohol, high-risk sports, etc. After all, some people may suffer detrimental effects as a result of those things and wind up costing the taxpayers who are forced to fund their care. We could further support a ban on reproduction by people who do not meet some minimum level of government-approved preparation for parenthood. This would be a defensive measure to ensure that the taxpayers do not wind up paying for the care of children whose parents are unprepared to care for them properly. There would, of course, have to be penalties imposed on anyone who refuses to comply. We could all go on for quite a while with these sorts of analogous examples, but I hope we can see why this is a bad path to be going down. In fact, this is the sort of logic supporting the war on drugs, which I think most of us agree has been incredibly devastating in terms of property rights and other rights as well. I think we ought to ask ourselves, is this the direction we as pro-freedom advocates want to be going? Next, let's look at a couple of common but faulty assumptions about the facts of the situation, the assumptions from which that bad argument proceeds. The first is that immigrants do not contribute significantly to public coffers. That may seem intuitive, but it's incorrect. Even illegal immigrants pay more than just sales tax. They pay excise taxes such as fuel, alcohol, and tobacco taxes. They pay property taxes, primarily indirectly through rent. Millions of undocumented workers are having income taxes withheld, and some even file income tax forms and pay additional income tax beyond what is withheld by their employers. The Social Security Administration estimates that about 3/4 of undocumented workers pay payroll taxes, Social Security, Medicare, to the tune of several billions of dollars annually. The second is that immigrants are a significant burden on social services. That may also seem intuitive based on common stereotypes of illegal immigrants, but it's also incorrect. Let's look at some rough numbers and do a little back-of-the-envelope calculation. On the asset side of the balance sheet, we have the money we would save by getting rid of the three Department of Homeland Security departments, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Customs and Border Protection, and Citizenship and Immigration Services. According to the Department of Homeland Security's 2010 budget, these divisions add up to more than $20 billion out of taxpayers' pockets, which they would be saved with an open borders policy. Additionally, a rough estimate of the tax contributions of illegal immigrants through payroll and federal income taxes alone is around $11 billion. By ending the closed borders policy, we'd have a net benefit of at least $31 billion. This, of course, does not account for all the tax dollars currently paid by illegal immigrants as detailed above. Nor does it account for the additional taxes immigrants would pay when they no longer risk deportation for doing so. Nor does this account for the additional taxes that would be paid by immigrants who would certainly have a much higher standard of living if they were able to compete for wages on an equal basis with legal residents. Nor does this account for the taxes paid by legal citizens born in the United States who are children of illegal immigrants. This is clearly a lowball. On the liability side of the balance sheet, we are looking at those public services Lance is worried about immigrants consuming. However, they are actually quite limited. In 1996, the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act was signed into law, affecting numerous changes to taxpayer-funded social programs. It has significant ramifications for immigrants. Since its passage, illegal immigrants have not been eligible for participation in most tax-funded social programs, with the exception of emergency medical care and public education. Further, most legal immigrants are not eligible for any but these two social benefits for 5 years after they arrive in the United States. So what we are looking at on this side of the balance sheet are primarily emergency medical care and public education. I take the following rough numbers from two notoriously anti-immigration sources. Note that the first organization is a spinoff of the second. The Center for Immigration Studies' current estimate for the cost to taxpayers of medical care at all levels of government to be $4.3 billion. The Federation for American Immigration Reform estimated in 2005 that the national cost for K-12 education for minors in the country, illegally plus minors who are citizens but whose parents entered illegally at $28.6 billion. This was the hardest number to pin down. I was unable to find more recent data, if it exists. Now, this is a little bit of a case of comparing apples to oranges due to the nature of data I was able to track down. The negative side of the balance sheet includes the cost of U.S. citizen children born to illegal immigrants, but the positive side does not include the tax contributions of those same individuals, and yet the difference is still less than $2 billion. To put that into context, the projected 2010 budgets for the departments providing social services to United States citizens, education, health, and human services, housing and urban development, labor, veterans affairs, and social security total $251.8 billion, meaning that a very conservative estimate for the impact of illegal immigrants on taxpayers is less than 1% of the total taxpayer social services burden. Evening the balance sheet a little bit, Shaka Dalmia of the Reason Foundation reports that the National Research Council found that when the taxes paid by the children of low-skilled immigrant families, most of whom are illegal, are factored in, they contribute on average $80,000 more to federal coffers than they consume over their lifetimes. In fact, numerous studies over the years, since at least 1980, have found that immigrants on average contribute more than they cost. I acknowledge that the numbers are rough here. Separating out money for unjust drug war actions and other things entangled with immigration issues is not straightforward. It is a bit beyond the scope of this blog post to do an in-depth analysis, but I think I've built in significant generosity to the negative side of the balance sheet such that it errs quite a bit out of my favor. For instance, I believe the fair number of K-12 education assumes that all children of immigrants of K-12 age are attending school. That is hardly the case and makes for a ridiculous overestimate. If anyone would like to discuss numbers more specifically, I invite you to post your comments. The problem is not that immigrants aren't contributing. Rather, you can see the source of the problem from the cost-benefit data above. Immigrants' contributions primarily go to the federal government, whereas the services they receive come primarily from state and local governments whose finances reflect this disparity. Immigrants are paying for benefits they will never receive, leaving them with fewer resources to pay for what they do use. Further, the ability of working illegal immigrants to raise their own standard of living through their own efforts is severely limited by the government policies and enforcement measures that force them to work underground or take away their livelihood altogether. Note that government enforcement actions are very pointedly focused on stopping immigrants from earning a living via voluntary market transactions. During the Bush administration, there were several high-profile raids that led to the deportation of hundreds of working immigrants, people who were not sponging off the system, but rather whose wages, harder earned than most folks, were taken from them to provide to United States citizens benefits these workers are themselves to receive. The Obama administration has elected to continue raiding the pocketbooks of working immigrants. This past summer, ICE began an audit of 652 companies looking to weed out working immigrants whose employment is not government approved. Minnesota Public Radio reports that in the last couple of months, for example, 1,200 workers were fired in the Twin Cities area in Minnesota from janitorial jobs paying good wages. These workers were put out of their jobs after ICE reviewed their records and found them lacking. And the abuse extends to lower levels of government as well. For example, Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, America's most abusive sheriff, is notorious for conducting worksite raids. Undocumented immigrants must work underground, thereby harming their standard of living through lower wages in exchange for employers looking the other way with regard to the paperwork. They pay taxes that go to fund benefits they are ineligible to receive, further harming their standard of living and effectively subjecting them to one of the most regressive tax structures among all workers in the United States. And then, in the face of all that, working immigrants are targeted by law enforcement through worksite raids and pressure on their employers to get rid of them. Who has a more legitimate claim to being cheated and abused by the system than these people? The focus on social services, paid for by taxpayers, as an excuse for discrimination and rights violations by way of government against millions of people, citizens and non-citizens alike, would be laughable were it not so horrifyingly tragic for so many people who put their lives on the line time and again to make an honest living and take care of themselves and their loved ones. This excuse is worn embarrassingly thin at this point, and it should be abandoned immediately. It only serves to divert attention away from the rightful focus on wealth redistribution schemes and the vast majority of their dependents who are United States citizens. The way to deal with excessive taxpayer burden from public social services is not to compound the problem with additional violations via unjust border policy, but rather to focus on undoing the rights violations that created that burden in the first place. And that was a blog post by Kirsten from freeagents.com on immigration, property rights, and freedom. Rabble Rouser, are you back with us? Are you tuned up?
Yes, sir.
Sweet. That's I know that was long, but I really liked that article, and it really hit a lot of good points.
Really,
and also,
really well written, Kirsten. It's a really well written article, and it really dispels a lot of the myths that that need to be dispelled. I still take issue with it, but you know, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, and as you should, as you know, we've been talking in chat about just like the fact that not only will people disagree, but they, you know, they actually should. My purpose in bringing this on was to give a different perspective, but also to give people some, one of the things in this particular school of anarchy that's really into economics is they look at numbers and they look at data. And these people tend to go, look, your claim is not backed up by any kind of empirical evidence whatsoever. And here it is. It's very kind of, in an often case, kind of unemotional and almost sounds amoral, but it also gives us sometimes some good hard data to refute a lot of the stereotypes. So that was my purpose for bringing that on, and just because I like the sound of my own voice, and I got to talk for a really long fucking time. You know what I'm saying? All right, so Rabble Rouser, please, play us the music.
Tell me if you can hear that. Can you hear that?
Indeed, I could. Yep.
Here we go. My banjo.
Yeehaw!
Oh yeah. I do
there
so love Ned Beatty.
There you go, Tony in Ohio.
Good news.
My issue with that. Let's discuss the different views on immigration. I feel, counterpoint to what Kirsten says, immediately I'm turned off by because it is a discussion based on numbers and based on statistics, and like
right.
you said, empirical evidence, which is a great term to use when talking about evidence stated by statistics put out in any format by any statistician, especially those working in economics, more specifically those working in economics of the state. It is empirical evidence of an empire.
Mm-hmm.
The economy, period, is evidence of an empire.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it addresses financial issues and tends to want to ease people's worries about their money. Problem with that being, people that are angry about immigration now aren't angry because it's costing them money. They're angry about job loss. And it's always hilarious to me that they say things like, well, they're coming in and taking our jobs. But it's never once shown that, well, they're coming in and my boss is selling my job for cheaper to somebody else. They get angry at the worker who needs work, that accepts work, but they don't get angry at the fat white fuckhead who's getting every fucking dollar that he can out of him and doesn't care about the family that is at home waiting for the paycheck from the person who is at work 40
right.
plus hours a week.
Right.
Let's put the blame where the blame is due. Blame the fucking bosses. And by the way, they will always have nicer cars than you. They will always have a nicer house. And they'll never have to worry about job security because they're fucking murderers, thieves, and liars.
Yeah,
blame
indeed.
The bosses. Don't ever, ever blame a co-worker until you're in the resistance and you feel like you're in comradeship with these people. Can we start saying things like turncoats and whatnot? But in the meantime, you are your worst enemy if you blame the boss for the woes put upon you by, I mean, if you don't blame the boss, you're your worst enemy. Because the boss is the one who is exploiting. And exploitation was taking place on your head for $8 an hour. Now it's taking place on the family of an immigrant family who's getting it for $2 an hour. Meanwhile, the boss is still making the same amount of profits or the same amount of money that he was making when you were working, but it's multiplied because he doesn't have to pay benefits. He doesn't have to worry about job security. He doesn't have to pay a living wage. And it doesn't matter. He's making more money now because of these fuckers, and you're still getting shit. So who should be blamed here? The guy who's barely making it or the guy who is making it much easier off of the burdens of both you and the new worker who's taking your place?
No, yeah, absolutely. And I completely agree with you, man. And you know, I was at a meetup last night. It was actually it was really great. I really met some cool people. It's something I really love about, you know, old man anarchists. You know what I mean? I think because you were telling me, Rabble Rouser, weeks back, you went to this thing and you met, yeah, the people there were okay, but there was one guy you particularly liked. It was this old dude, this old anarchist, right? And it was a really cool meetup. A lot of different kinds of people, and this one cat was just talking about that. You know, in life, really, when he looks back on his life and he thinks about, you know, like what really has been the most profitable experiences in his life, you know, that really just best gave him a better life and improved his lifestyle, wasn't having things and wasn't buying things. It was his friendships and his relationships and, you know, the connections he made with other people. And one of the things I got to thinking about was, you know, I'm like, that, you know, that's so amazing to me. And we're a lot of folks in this room, we're all kind of like-minded on a lot of these ideas. And there were a few, though, that I disagreed with because they still supported some amount of the system as we have it now in terms of, from my point of view, in this group, the state, and which I think we could both agree Robert Rouser is inherently, you know, that particular organization and big business and just everything around us is inherently, you know, this top-down thing with all of us on the bottom and very few on top. And I think people, one of the things we have to realize is in terms of anarchism is that we've got to bring that all down. We have to bring that all down. Like, blaming the worker who's taking a huge cut for somehow making your life bad is a complete trick of the system. It's meant to divide you against your fellow human like that so that you'll stay nice and distracted from the guys who are driving around in the really nice cars and will always have better cars than you and will always have bigger houses than you.
Well, and the reason that those people have positions of power and authority and have those things is because we continue to view ourselves as less. Not because we necessarily view them as worth more, because everybody hates the fucking boss. Everybody hates rich people. Everybody fucking hates them. So we don't respect these assholes, but we just highly distrust and disrespect ourselves. We demoralize ourselves on a daily basis for the benefit of these fucking jerk-offs, and we hate them, but we give them their positions of authority because we distrust and demoralize ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's what it comes down to. It's identity politics are as easy as how we identify ourselves. And
totally.
When we start to allow colonialization identity politics, meaning the colonizer identifies you for yourself, that's when we've been assimilated and colonized. If we refuse that, and if we refute that, which many have done over the years, and there's been reason to kill them for this, but the instant refusal of identification by somebody else of who you are is the first step in a positive resistance. It could even be a nonviolent resistance that could work as long as we view ourselves as the worthy beings we are. But there's a catch for all of you people who think you do that already. Think about how you view other sentient living creatures. And I'm not just talking about cows and chickens and things like that, because I do eat meat. Think about how you view trees. Think about how you view water. Think about how you view land. Think about how you view products. And if you use the term resources when talking about these things, automatically you are attaching an identity to those things that are not those things. Trees are trees. They're not money. They're not. And if you continue to view them as resources, then we continue to be the colonizer and at the same time be colonized by empirical ideas. So that's a major step. And it's
so, sorry to interrupt. We also have a caller. I wanted to let you know you're on the line, and we're not neglecting you. We have a caller, Rob Rouser. Somebody called in to talk to us.
All right. Who is it?
Hi, this is Tony in Ohio, guys.
What up?
Hey, what's up, Tony in Ohio?
Yeah.
We lost the connection in the chat room. The dang thing keeps buffering, so I figured I'd call in and listen, and then I figured I'd just hit the button. Why not?
Fuck it. There's only like seven other people listening anyway, man. You don't even have to worry about it.
So what's
on your mind, Tony?
What's your thoughts on the immigration issue and what we've been saying so far?
I talked about the immigration thing once on my show, and I basically just laid it out. Like, I don't believe in kicking in doors on people that, obviously are nonviolent people, aren't hurting anybody. For the most part, they do contribute to the system. And obviously, if they're not taking away more from the system than they're contributing, they aren't committing any type of theft, which would be, you know, on the market side considered a type of violence. So, I mean, like, I don't know. To me, borders are just lines drawn on maps. And the only thing that border hawks have a point about economically really is the emergency rooms. But that's more of a case for universal care, whether you're talking about market-oriented or not, than it is for a closed border policy. So I'm with you guys on the open border thing.
Yeah, and yet again another instance of placing the blame on the fellow oppressed. When you're talking about emergency room, it's like, well, we don't take into account why it's so fucking expensive to go to the hospital in America.
Right, exactly.
Nothing to do with the actual cost. It has to do with the arbitrary cost of medical care. And
well,
somebody once told me that you should be a plumber. If you want job security, be a plumber because you can charge what you want because people might not want to pay it, but they'd rather not live in their own shit. And so it's the same thing with medical care. It's like, well, you can charge whatever the fuck you want because you have a monopoly on this stuff.
Yeah,
and we've completely discouraged all forms of natural health care, let alone healthy living.
Well, last night,
we blame the people that are sick. We don't blame the asshole charging $300 for a fucking Band-Aid.
Last night at this meetup I was at, one of the women there was talking about a cat she knew, saw a documentary about or something to that effect, who had got to spend some time with some indigenous folk in, I think in Africa, in the African continent. And, they were out in the jungle, and he's like, so, I mean, like, you know, where's your fucking, you know, this is exactly, I'm saying it verbatim, by the way, he was like, where's your fucking, goddammit, shit, balls and cocks? He said, where's your medicine and your produce? I mean, like, what do you got? And they're like, oh, well, it's all right here. It's all around us. You know, you look at, here's this point at this tree, here's our medicine, you know, and here's what we eat for this, and this, what this does this for us, you know, like, people, what am I trying to say right now? I'm so fucking high, you guys, seriously. Seriously, like, I do a fucking radio show. I have no idea what I just said, like, past 5 minutes. Jesus.
I couldn't follow you at all. I heard shit, motherfucker, cocks, and balls. Where is he going with it? And then right before that, you prepped it with it, and this is verbatim. I'm like, what are you.
I just wondered who he was quoting. I lost track of the
conversation. Yeah,
like, who are you quoting there? That'd be great.
What kind of people do you hang out with? Like,
oh, dude. You know, like, it's one of those things. Well, you know, it's not so much Tourette's, Tony, as it is I just really, really, really love swearing.
I like it, too.
Yeah.
I fucking love it, but I really love it. Like, I would say, like, if people were like, you know, what do you like to do? You know, I'd be like, okay, I like to read books. I like to play Dungeons & Dragons. I like to fucking swear a lot.
Hey, you know what? You know why my kids don't swear?
Why?
Because I don't fucking swear.
I hear that, brother.
Yeah.
Fucking hear that bullshit. Hey, guys, by the way, I've been wanting to say this on, like, good news. Wall Street has had record profits for 2009. So, good
thank
news.
Thank God. I was so worried there. My God, Obama's really paying off. Thank God.
I know. I know.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, Tony, what are your what's your points of view on the whole the bailouts and Wall Street and the new presidency? Give us some perspective, my man.
Well, I just was of the opinion that we are rather mercantilistic. We've been mercantilist for a long time, and we never got away from it. And it just goes in cycles. The state lets up a little bit here, tightens a little bit there, and then it always appears that they're, you know, loosening the belt, but they never really loosen the noose on you. You know, everything that they've done all along for the last 30 to 50 years has been mercantilistic. They've chosen favorites, just like the English courts, you know, the parliament used to do. They would, you know, pick their favorites out of the House of Lords, and that would be the companies that thrived, and they'd give them what we consider today corporate welfare, which is what they've been doing, you know, to the tune of like $80 billion a year for as long as I've been alive anyway. And, you know, now they come up with these bailouts, and I was just totally against the bailouts. It's like, why are we, you know, you have to let these things collapse. You have to liquidate the bad debt. There's just nothing else you can do. You can't stop what's going to happen. You can slow it, and that's what they're doing, and I guess that's better than a full-fledged collapse, but I'd have rather seen that money spent on unemployment insurance for everybody and let the unemployment rate go to 30%. People aren't naturally lazy. They'll try to go back to laborious activity as soon as possible so that they can make a better living. They don't want to live in poverty. And obviously, unemployment is no cakewalk, so I didn't understand the logic behind it. And if you're going to bail anybody out anyway, and you're going to get accused of being a socialist for doing it, you could have at least just paid off the mortgages of all these people that were in trouble, and that way giving the bank their liquidity that they so desperately, quote-unquote, needed because they were too big to fail, and then, you know, take that bill away from people every month, and that's a huge stimulus. Instead, they send you a $500 check one time. What if you got that $500 check every single month because they paid your mortgage off, or $1,000 every month? They could have gave those banks that liquidity and just simply said, this is payment for those mortgages, so count those mortgages as paid. They didn't do that because it's not socialization. It's mercantilism.
Well, and you know, the interesting thing about housing is that a house is only paid for once. And the way that it works is a bank, when you buy a house, you purchase it for much more than its actual value is, number one. And then add on the interest, what you're actually paying shoots up even higher than the ticket price that you purchased the house for. And that house has already changed hands multiple times. The bank has already been paid for that house, yet they will continue to resell the same house. It's kind of like the old question, who makes more money, a drug dealer or a prostitute? The answer is a prostitute because she can wash her crack and resell it. And that's exactly what banks are doing with these houses. They've already been paid for. It's not as if that they're losing money on these things. These things have already been paid in full many times over, and they're using it as, it's a form of slavery. It's land control and it's slavery, and beyond that, it's control of movement. It controls who gets to move where, who gets to live where, and in what neighborhoods. You know, for instance, 60 years ago, 70 years ago, it was illegal for a black person, well, longer than 70 years, it's 2009 already, I would say probably 85 years ago, it was illegal for a black person to live in the city limits of Portland, Oregon. And now there's a small population of black people that live in Portland, Oregon, and they occupy pretty much one location in the town, and now that is being purchased up and renovated out and overpriced for the average income of black families, and so black mothers specifically are losing their homes, and they're being forced to leave. So all they did was make it legal for them to live here long enough to profit from them, and now they're going to kick black people back out of the city because, you know, it's not illegal, but it's not economically advantageous.
Yeah, absolutely. It's exactly what's going on right now. I mean, there's so many people are being boosted out to the outer southeast area. And it's complete population displacement to obvious gentrification. You know, something else that you touched on, Michael, that I think is really important is the idea of restricting movement. And I know, again, Michael, you and a lot of our listeners aren't into markets and stuff like that, but I do want to mention that in Austrian economics specifically, one of the fundamental aspects of a freely operating market system is freedom of movement, that people have to be able to move around. They have to. If that movement is ever restricted, then you end up with huge imbalances and in terms of, you know, dry market economics talk aside, imbalances being like fucking really poor demographics, people completely suffering and completely, you know what I'm saying? So from even from an economic point of view, restricting people's movements creates these huge imbalances, which we can and then we can, you know, we can see all around us in the immense suffering
of people. Beyond restricting freedom of movement is actually the forced movement is even worse, because what that
does is
it displaces anybody from land which they could cultivate. And,
yeah.
you know, it's that's as old as any empire, that
sure.
knowing that when the poor obtain land, control land, and can produce for themselves, they become less consumeristic, they have stake in something, and they're willing to fight for something. And the land being taken away, and this is a plan that actually, speaking of racial gentrification, this plan went into play in the 1970s. After the 68 Detroit riots, there was the Kerner Commission to study the Detroit riots, and they decided that a highly concentrated population of one specific minority who was economically disadvantaged is more likely to rise up and revolt together than if they were deconcentrated. And so they came up with spatial deconcentration, and they used the HUD program, Housing and Urban Development, from the 50s, as the tool for spatial deconcentration. Section 8 housing, government housing, and they started splitting families up, splitting neighborhoods up, and St. Louis was the first testing ground for this, and anybody who's ever been through St. Louis, where I just lived, you'll see that as you cruise through neighborhoods, it literally goes block by block and sometimes house by house as to where the rich are and where they aren't. The gentrification there looks much different than it does in other cities. There, it's very much splitting apart the black communities and the Latino communities, and spreading them out. That way there is no unification of the impoverished or the oppressed. Because if the oppressed can come together, recognize each other's plight, they're more likely to fight together. And that's exactly what racism is. Racism is a tool used by the state to separate poor, specifically poor European immigrants, from one another. And it works really easily across color lines and ethnic background lines. But white-on-white racism was a big thing in the development of this nation, because you had poor Polish, poor Italian, and poor Irish, and poor German immigrants all occupying the same spaces in Manhattan, and they started turning them against one another by saying things like, you're not going to let that Italian take your job, are you? You're Irish. Be proud. You're not going to let that German take your job, are you? You're Italian. Be proud. And next thing you know, you had, you know, WAPs need not apply, Irish need not apply on white-owned businesses, because there had to be a form of separation and division. There had to be a spatial deconcentration.
The only problem with this whole system that they try to employ with the trying to separate the powers, so to speak, breaking up communities, it hasn't worked and it's not going to work. The problem that they're having now is we have a economic resegregation. The schools are largely resegregated into inner city, you know, schools that suck, and the outer level, you know, the suburban and rich neighborhood schools that don't suck. Even in rural poor neighborhoods, these schools pretty much suck. You know what I mean? So it's gotten to the point where everybody's being resegregated according to economics, and lo and behold, those who they've classified as either a race that's less than desirable or sex, in the case of women, who are the majority yet are treated as a minority, you know, that's less than desirable. Anything that they've decided that's less than desirable is congregating together. It has to happen. You're going to get more single mothers, and they're going to concentrate in the same areas, and they're going to go to the same schools, and we're reconcentrating against their plan, because their plan in essence is complete coercion. It can't work. The more they try
Which is exactly what force will be the next step of the state, and it already is showcasing itself in roadblocks and in any street action now, where we have 3,000 cops and 2,000 National Guard there beating the heads of protesters in. That's
right.
Just a warm-up for what's going to be happening to everybody on the streets, as a reminder that don't get out of line, because they see that happening. And force will be the next step. The first step against all this, if you'll notice, there's I think I've mentioned this before, there's a South African leader who said that reform is what fascist governments or the empires do when they see themselves falling out of favor with the people. and they see a revolution coming, they reform themselves to maintain their power and make the people think they're changing.
Right.
I can't think of a greater reform for this country than Barack Hussein Obama.
That's a good point.
I mean, isn't that one of the largest social reforms we've seen in this country? To see a black man become president who has borderline socialist policies, these things, that is the definition of a social reform. And the word reform itself, let's break it down, reform. Reformation, reformation, a reformation of power. It's not a restructuring of power. It's not like we strip it down and restructure it differently. It just reforms itself.
Oh, absolutely. And we've been talking about kind of the refining process. You know, in a show weeks back, we talked about the National Socialist Party as an experiment and how far they could push it. And over the years, it's become so refined because, you know, from my perspective, the way I see the world is that, you know, slavery never ended. It became the prison industry. It became the public school industry, you know.
It became worse.
And they've refined it to such a degree that, you know, certain things that normally we'd seem as abhorrent, if done in this very kind of very refined, you know, and I got to, you know, credit where credit is due. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's very masterfully constructed to appear very innocuous and very caring for the people around us, and everyone feels like they're very involved because we have our free speech, quote unquote, we have our constitution, we have all these things. And in my mind, and I know this probably sounds pretty conspiratorial, but I'm going to say that's because what it is that the system is designed to create manageable demographics of crime and unrest and it's meant to create large scale unhappiness.
Well, because it thrives upon them. It needs them.
Yeah.
You need to have an elusive enemy at your door, because without that, that'll be the state's purpose is defense. That's what states claim their purpose to be. That's what states historically have their purpose to be, and that's still what states claim their purpose is. Well, to have a group that you would pay X amount of dollars to and you would surrender freedoms to defend you, you'd have to have an enemy. You would have to have
mm-hmm.
some kind of disincentive or incentive
right.
to keep this around. Otherwise, it wouldn't happen. And, I mean, it's simple. The enemies change all the time, but it's always the same idea. It's always the boogeyman outside the door, outside the gates. It's you know, and when they can't keep it outside of the gates, they inject it internally to keep fear as their position of control. And the problem is we've actually created enemies. We've turned the world into the enemy of the American people. Not necessarily at the fault of the American people, but at the cost of the American people, because we've raped, pillaged, and destroyed this entire fucking planet and disenfranchised people the world over, creating enemies. This is my major problem with a lot of 9/11 truthers. Yeah, do I believe that our government had knowledge? Absolutely. Do I believe that our government had the gall and the will to do something so heinous? Absolutely. But I don't want to discount the fact that people are so angry that they would be willing to do that. That they would be willing to fly a plane into a building. I don't want to discount their anger and their valid anger, because we've fucked people over.
One thing,
and it's
one
not
way
even I've us. It's the top 3%.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the boss.
And you know, I you know what I always tried to, you know, because I you know I'm right there with you, my man. Is that when I fucking imagine the kind of the emotion that it takes to carry one to that point of hijacking a plane to deliberately crash it. You know, the range of emotions, that's no arbitrary thing. And the way I've always tried to think of it and put it to friends is, you know, imagine your fucking wife goes to the store to get a gallon of milk and doesn't come home because a bomb from another government dropped on that store that day and she was killed. You know, imagine what that would be like. I mean, you know, fuck Michael Moore, he's a fat ass and he's a prick, but in Fahrenheit 9/11, where he showed clips from in Iraq of a woman whose house had just been bombed, and you know, weeping and cursing the sky, you know, just you know, praying to God to destroy America. You know, it's fucking no small potatoes, man. That's fucking real shit. And and again, the system is it's the failsafe of the system at this point is that it pushes itself forward, you know what I mean? It reaffirms itself, and by saying, you know, it, 9/11 happens. It's a horrible tragedy. So many people died, and it was so painful and so sad. And that helped to reinforce that we have an enemy to fight. And so we still need the system, you know, this the marriage of uglies of this, like, socialist capitalist state. It's just horrible.
Well, stopped and said, why did 9/11 happen? Everybody just said, who did?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
The talking heads on TV never said, well, why would such a tragedy take place? Why would people attack us? Why would you think that they hate our freedoms? Can you please elaborate? Can you please explain, number one, what our freedoms are? Because I'd like to fucking know what your idea of my freedom is. That's hilarious to me, number one. Number two, please explain to me why they would hate that. And number three, why they would go to such ends to do that. And by the way, do you know the difference between a suicide bomber and a soldier of the state?
Yeah, right.
A soldier lives to kill again. That's the only difference.
Yeah.
A suicide
yeah.
bomber lives to kill once, and a soldier lives to kill again.
That's the major difference, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, we send our kids off to fight and die every day. We send suicide bombers in every day. You know, I have friends that are in the military, and they say, you know, to go into Ramada or go into Sifaluja was commonly known as suicide missions. That you're going in, and there's a good chance you're not coming back. So deal with that. But wear your fucking yellow ribbon and tie it around your cock, my friend, because that's all it's about good for.
Dude, I got in a big discussion. It wasn't like an argument. They were pretty cool about it. But I got in this big thing with somebody. I'm like, if you're so for all these wars and stuff and you think they're justified, then why don't you just make the military voluntary for each conflict? Like, of course, you'd have people that would say, I'm blanketing volunteering for everything because they're gung-ho as hell. But a lot of people, man, they don't want to go to these separate conflicts. You know, we've had just recently that guy that shot that, you know, all them poor people at Fort Hood. And they're, you know, part of it was Islamic stuff and all that, and I didn't deny the connection to that, but, you know, some of it is just, hey, the dude didn't want to go to, you know, Iraq to kill people that look like him. You know, if it was, I think a lot of the problems we have with, you know, going to war and all this imperialism is it's not voluntary. If you could volunteer for the conflicts, I don't agree with the conflicts, but at least if you could volunteer for them, then I could say, you know what, we deserve whatever we get on the rebound with this because, you know, we had enough people volunteer for this to actually make a political dent. And then if somebody, you know, gets pissed at us about it, then who do we have to blame for but ourselves? But right now, all we have to blame is the state. That's all we have to blame for everything because they pick what wars we go to, what wars we stay in, how long we stay, how much our children are going to pay for it because we're not paying for it. You know, we can't afford it. So, I don't know.
Right. Well, and like Ward Churchill says, let's really do follow their rhetoric. Let's take them word for word on their word, and let's do exactly what they say. You want to go fight the oppressive forces? No problem. I'll get a plane ticket to D.C. tomorrow. you want to go fight the colonizers? No problem. It's really easy to take a downtown train to fucking Manhattan. Not a problem. Let's do it. Let's go fight the colonizers right now. You want to fight the people that hate your freedoms? No problem. There's plenty of cops in your streets. Yeah, let's fight those that hate our freedom.
But they
I have no problem with that rhetoric.
They don't want to make it voluntary for people in the military to decide what conflicts they go to because they know they won't get in any conflicts. Nobody wants to go to war to go get themselves killed without a lot of convincing, A, and B, because they think there's some kind of threat. Like you said, they put up some type of threat. I mean, obviously, if it's not a self-defense situation, who the hell wants to go to war? They go on order.
Well,
they go on fake duty. You know what I mean?
Let's make the military responsible for funding itself. If you want to be patriotic, awesome. Then Dick Cheney, be a patriot and donate your services. Because you're asking us to donate our services, so you
right.
donate yours. Let's not make $10 billion next year off of warheads. How about that? Let's not make $50 billion off of contracting to feed our soldiers. Let's donate that shit. Donate it, and we'll see how quickly we have our leaders who have to donate their time and donate their resources entering us into these conflicts because it's fucking expensive to go to these conflicts, and
oh,
they
sure.
know it is because they get paid for it.
Imagine if they
write the bill.
Imagine if they had to send out fucking representatives who went door to door, and you know, they come to your door and they're like, "Hello, Rabble Rouser. It's nice to see you. So this organization I am, we're going to go invade this other country. We're going to need about 10 grand a day from you to fund that. So would you be willing to do that?" And you might answer with an affirmative.
Hell no.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. You can get the fuck off of my porch. You didn't see that black flag on your way up, did you?
Yeah. Oh, shit.
It's pretty big and flying right there, ass face. But
hey, I wanted to play. I have one more clip I want to play before as we round into our last 20 minutes. It's because we've talked a lot.
Well,
about...
actually, I kind of have to go.
Okay.
I'm gonna get off here. But Tony, are you gonna stay on and do the show with Travis?
Yeah, I'll talk to him for a bit.
Yeah.
G20, do you mind if I bow out gracefully?
Rob Rouser, you may bow out gracefully. Have a wonderful night with
okay,
your family.
I do want to say before we go that everybody should tell their friends and listen in next week. And if you're in the Pacific Northwest, it's actually not next week. It's the week after next.
2 weeks.
2 weeks from now, we will be the only live studio audience on stage anarchist radio show of any sort, kind of like a Cascadia homeless companion. and it's gonna be great times. And our first guest is none other than the singer and keyboardist of one of the longest running anarchist bands in history, Chumbawamba from England. You're gonna know a lot of people are gonna hear them. They're gonna know them from Tub Thumper. But the band's been around for a long time. They've done split LPs with Noam Chomsky. They've been instrumental, no pun intended, in a lot of resistance movements, having played multiple riots. And all of the proceeds, or a lot of the proceeds, and we'll have Amber talk about this, from their radio singles went to fund various resistance groups. So prisoner support groups and whatnot. So, you know, Dan Burt No Bacon is going to be on our show. He's coming down from Twist, Washington, to join us to play music and talk politics. Live at Muddy Waters Cafe. So we're really
going to be fucking awesome. It's going to be fucking awesome. Awesome. Rabble Rouser, have a great night, my man. I'll talk to you again soon.
You too, man. Love you, brother.
Love you, too.
Talk to you later.
All right, Tony. Well, if you're going to stay with me, I've got a clip I want to play, and we can talk about that for a couple minutes as we close out the show. This is a little five-minute bit. This is presenting anarchism as skepticism.
The government is necessary. The government is legitimate. Democracy is representative of the people. Democracy is the best form of government. Majority rule is legitimate. Checks and balances actually function. Voting is meaningful or even an obligation. We have a meaningful choice between political parties or candidates. Governments form as a result of the social contract. The good of society, the rule of law. Law provides order. Only the government can provide certain services. Society must be modeled or planned. Without a pre-existing design, there cannot be a society. What do all of these things have in common? They are political myths, incoherent abstractions, and apologetic devices. Before a political discussion even takes place, generally most of this is simply assumed. But why do we have to assume legitimacy in order to have a discussion or debate in the realm of politics? Are these not assumptions that must be proven to begin with? A claim of authority isn't something that is legitimate before any argumentation takes place. It must be proven like any other positive claim. Unfortunately, in the bulk of political discourse, such positive claims are simply assumed, and calling them into question is like sticking a monkey wrench into the conversation. You're simply looked at as crazy. But why is it taboo to question these assumptions and concepts? Technically, one need not make any positive assertions at all in order to come to an anarchistic conclusion. All that is necessary is that one retains skepticism towards the positive assertions that are common in political discourse, and to consequentially deconstruct the language and the assumptions of politics. Once one is consistently engaged in such a deconstruction, one eventually is left with the conclusion that political authority as such simply has no legitimate foundation. The alleged legitimate foundations are reduced to something that holds no more weight than the concept of a deity, which is to say, none at all. The anarchist rejects the idea that there is a particular political model that works for a society as such. It is erroneous to think of anarchism as if it is a political model. The function of the anarchist is the deconstruction of political models. The archist or statist is someone who maintains faith in a particular political model or process, or one who maintains faith in a particular person or group in a position of political authority. The function of the archist or statist is to justify these political models or authority figures. In this context, the anarchist is the skeptic, and the archist is the one who is maintaining faith. From a skeptical anarchist perspective, particularly the perspective of an atheist anarchist, the archist faith is analogous to the theist faith, the main difference being that the archist merely uses political authority in the same way that the theist uses the concept of a deity. In the same way that a creationist thinks that a deity must have created or planned the universe and all that follows from it, the archist seems to think that a political model and authority must have planned society in order for it to exist or function in the first place. In both cases, it is inconceivable to the advocate in question that order of any kind can arise without a central planner or designer. And just as the theist maintains faith in the ability of the deity to maintain the order of the universe once it has been created, the archist maintains faith in the ability of the political authority in question to maintain the order of the society that has allegedly been created. The archist must maintain faith in the ability of law generation and law enforcement to lead to the desired ends and sustain them. The archist must maintain faith in the ability of political authority to counteract the elements of dynamism within a society. The anarchist is merely a skeptic with regard to such beliefs. The historical connection between religion and politics is very interesting. The earliest justifications for political authority tended to be religious in nature. In some primitive cases, the legitimization was simply that the political authority literally was the religious authority or deity. This was watered down one step further with the notion that the political authority has the sanction of the deity, or at least the religious organization that represents such a deity, which in the context of European history is known as divine right. Before any notion of the social contract was formally put forth, the justification for political authority was overwhelmingly and blatantly religious. But with the fall of religious absolutism, such purely religious justifications began to be worn threadbare, and political philosophers began making comprehensive attempts at justifying political authority without a direct appeal to the divine. Instead, all they really did was anthropomorphize certain human beings or social groups or concepts in order to create a transcendental relationship in which society, or at least certain segments therein, are treated as if they were divine. In a strange roundabout way, the divine justification has merely been secularized, and the human also human has been divinized. In short, the traditional concept of a divine right that was formerly used to justify political authority has merely been shifted elsewhere. It has not been eliminated. Instead, abstractions such as society, or the people, or natural elites serve the exact same function. Instead of allowing their skepticism to end when religious absolutism starts to diminish, the anarchist calls such justifications into question as he sees them as no more reasonable than previous justifications.
All right, Tony, so what do you think?
Well, first of all, I've visited that particular guy's YouTube site before. I don't know if that's where you got that from. And I've heard his voice many times because he's got a lot of really good videos that kind of speak articulately more than I can on the subject of anarchism and its basic functions and dynamics. But I don't know. I agree with him. It is a skeptical point of view, and statism is more or less a faith. But it goes back, I like to use like where it started, and when you look at Western philosophy, it's built on a great dichotomy, and the dichotomy is that Socrates was killed by the state. He came in, he turned himself in, he took hemlock poison, walked till his limbs were heavy and died. Now, you would think that this political execution of somebody who was basically killed for corrupting the youth's minds through his words, you know, a nonviolent action, that the philosophy that was based around that would be popularized would be the one that would be anti-state. But in fact, it went the other way. Plato began the utopian. That's where he really lived, was Pluto.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a Freudian slip. But Plato, he comes up with the utopian state, which is a total ass-backwards reaction to the execution of Socrates. And yet,
right.
we hear nothing of Antisthenes, if I'm mispronouncing his name, forgive me, but his contemporary was Antisthenes, and that guy came up with the complete opposite, which was to say that the state was at fault here, that this was the problem, and that, you know, utopian state was a complete contradiction in terms, and openly mocked and laughed at Plato. But in the end, I think, personally, it's my personal theory, and here's my conspiracy theory, since you gave one earlier.
Cool.
I think that the state promoted and helped fund Plato's travels, and that's why he's so well recorded. Antisthenes is barely found. Diogenes Sinope is barely found. You know, all the cynics and Stoics that preached anti-statism, you know, anarchism as we know it today, although it probably didn't have a name back then because, I mean, obviously you have no reason to identify the natural way of being until the state forces you to, you know, to give it a name, you know. So they finally give it a name eventually, I think around Podhern, or what, if I'm mispronouncing his name, I apologize as well. But in the Great Workers International meetings with Marx and stuff, I think that's where they pretty much gave it a label, and he self-described himself as an anarchist. But that's what the Stoics and the Cynics were. That's, you know, it all goes back to that one execution, and the philosophy went one way, and the state supported it and made it really popular, and the dissenting point of view, the skeptical point of view, went the whole other way and was completely erased from history other than what few documents they have and what few oral histories they have.
And, you know, I think to add on to that, like, one, the idea of anarchism as skepticism is... You know, I've been myself in a lot of conversations with individuals about, you know, what the world will look like in a stateless society, which is particularly my focus as an anarchist. Is to me, that's who enemy number one is. And I know there's a lot of I'm not saying Walmart's my fucking friend either. I mean, their big business is also my enemy, but the state is, from my perspective, is our biggest blight, and it's also the one that's most ingrained, I think, in the populace's minds. At large, in chat, we're going back and forth about, well, you know, what do you mean by the system, and what do you mean by bring it down? You know, okay, the government in its current form should be brought down, and I tend towards a statement of, from my perspective, government should just be brought down. I'm highly, highly, highly skeptical to the point of complete unbelief that it's possible for a system systemically based in coercion. I.e., taxation is theft. If you don't pay, we'll put you in a cage at gunpoint. If you try and escape, we'll shoot you. That's the same dynamic of a criminal organization. And I think one of our jobs as anarchists, you know, if anarchism is what we subscribe to, is to constantly shine that light of uncredibility on the system, even when purported goods are happening. You know, at what cost do they come? At, you know, so. You know, some health care got passed, but look at all the huge amounts of wealth that are being geared towards, you know, the industrial monoliths, the pharmaceutical companies. They're going to make a lot of money off all of this legislation. And one of our jobs is to constantly, unfortunately, or fortunately, shine that light on it and at other people's, dismay and sometimes, you know, their depression. I got into a conversation the other day with a couple of friends and just about that I had, you know, finally mailed in my request to cancel my voter registration. And I said, you know, for me, it's really liberating to stop participating because, you know, I don't feel that urge to fight with my neighbors like I used to. You know, I don't feel that, you know, yeah, it sucks that they're going to try and enforce their beliefs on me and then I'm going to watch them go back and forth and just hate on each other. That sucks. But I don't have to be part of it anymore. You know, I actually hate pro-lifers a lot less than I used to. I mean, don't get me wrong, I still do. Narrow-minded twits are narrow-minded twits. But since I don't have to engage in that particular aspect of it, I'm a little less angry. And I think it's I hate to use the fucking Matrix. You know, I'm a total Matrix cult member. I just recently finished watching the fucking trilogy again, and I'm watching the animated ones. I'm totally fucking into it, and I think there's so many. It's so relevant to, you know, to me, that's what the system around us. That's what it is. This is this matrix, and we, in a lot of ways, can't see life
outside of it. We can't imagine that we could do anything as simple as build a bridge or a road without this organization, that we couldn't have buildings with teachers and students in them without this institution, that, you know, we even need this institution to validify marriage between people. It's just so ingrained. Even though anarchism is all around us, freedom is all around us. We every day make voluntary choices to do this, that, or the other thing. We just don't realize it, and we take it for granted.
The government largely is an illusion. I mean, we don't go through our daily lives corresponding to every dictate of the government. I mean, we all jaywalk. We all run red lights when nobody's around and we know nobody's going to get hurt. We all run stop signs. We roll through them with the old rolling stop. You know, slow down enough to where you could stop if there's some need to, but if there's nobody around, then you just go. I mean, everybody does these things. They all realize that the state is an illusion. It's not the state is an illusion. The control the state supposedly has is an illusion. Law, for the most part, other than natural law, is a complete illusion. I mean, it doesn't exist. It's all based on somebody's goofy ideas. When I try to explain to people, especially constitutionalists, when I'm explaining what I mean by anarchism, you know, because they all freak out, like, you want to get rid of the whole government, you know. It's like, dude, for 90% of what I'm going to talk about, you're going to agree with me. And you're going to want to ride with me on this, you know, if I can use a metaphor without, I don't want to at all imply violence, but this fight, you know, if you want to join this fight, it's not that I'm joining your fight, you know what I mean? It's that you're joining mine. You might want to jump off at a certain point because you're not comfortable with going any farther. And that's fine. You know, you want to jump off at the Constitution when we get back to it, go for it. You know, I'm not making you stay with me. But don't be mad at me that I want to go a bit farther, that I think that we should seek a utopia that maybe perhaps will never exist, and maybe it won't. But I think we should seek it, because if we don't put our eye on the prize as far as having no government, no institutions of coercion, whether you're talking about churches, schools, unions, you name it, any institution, if we don't seek that, then we're never going to ever aspire to get to that point. We're always going to aspire to get to a minarchist state, which it's never going to happen. When you aspire to minarchism, you eventually will allow the government to slowly grow, slowly get out of control. Then it allows the corporations to get out of control, and then they allow the mega churches to get out of control, and, you know, it just goes crazy. The whole country goes nuts, like it's going nuts now.
Well, you know, God bless you, Tony, because that's actually, remember earlier when I completely lost my train of thought because I smoked too much pot tonight? You just brought me back full circle, because that's actually what I was fucking trying to work up to, was the fact that, you know, I'm in this room with a lot of, you know, highly enlightened individuals, and some of them do support a small amount of the state for things just like cops and courts, per se. And I'm of the same perspective, that it's not possible. The system isn't designed that way. You know what I mean? It's literally the architects of this social institution. It did not intend for it to be something that shrunk and was humble. And that's not the intent. It's not built that way. It's built to expand. It's built on, you know, concepts like hoarding, you know, keeping food under lock and key, like Daniel Quinn talks about in Ishmael and the story of B. It's based on the amassing of power, you know, hoarding power and hoarding people.
It's the beast.
Right, I'm an absolute proponent of starving the beast. You know, I think that's one of the classic ways to fight it is to starve it. You know, start figuring out ways to subvert it and keep energy from it. Because, you know, open brawling with the state, you know, good luck.
And I'm a pragmatist as well. In other regions, and a lot of anarchists disagree with me on that. So I get flack from both sides. Some anarchists are completely against voting and think that voting is completely wrong and immoral. And I just look at it as a self-defense mechanism if you choose it. If it's something that you feel is necessary for self-defense, then I wouldn't blame you any more than I would if you defended yourself in a physical fight. You know what I mean? But at the same time, I don't think it does what people think it does. You know what I mean? It doesn't have this magical, you know, power that we're actually making decisions. They give us the decisions we can make. You know, all we get to do is vote in self-defense and pick the person that's least likely to screw us in the butt, you know. But just because, you know, like, and I didn't mean that in an anti-gay way either, the whole idea, like, that you're gonna say that voting's immoral and stuff kind of bothers me, because I think the only way you really ever could tear down a state is to do it from within. You have to work within its mechanisms until you can dismantle the mechanisms. And it's layers of layers of layers of things, and you have to start out with basic things and then start peeling away the layers. Like, if you can install term limits, that would be very good. If you could outlaw monetary lobbying, that would be pretty good. You know, that would that'd be like a separation of corporation and state, because obviously, as anarchists, we know when you take two institutions and mix them, they're going to corrupt each other. Even if one's okay, the other one's going to get infected. You know what I mean? You can't have institutions that are bad in nature from our point of view. So they're all infected already, and all they can do is reinfect each other, and it's bad. It's like having AIDS and having sex with somebody with AIDS. It's never good for you.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, it's like you could take, you know, any, and I've been saying this since we first started doing the show, is that any socioeconomic system, no matter how interesting or cool or innovative it may sound on paper, once it's mixed with a coercive organization like the state, it becomes significantly skewed and damaged. We've got about 8 seconds left in the show, so I just want to say thanks so much, Tony, for being on with us tonight and staying with me to wrap up the show. And I want everybody in Portland, Oregon, and the Pacific Northwest, December 6th will be Burns' first show live in front of an audience at Muddy Waters Cafe in Southeast Portland, a worker-owned place. Thanks so much for being with us tonight, you guys. Good night.